This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 27. And I'm delighted to welcome on the show Stephen Mendel, CEO of that most rara of Arvis, an insurance fintech. Fintech is, of course, new digital technologies impacting upon financial services as a whole, not just banks, as folks are wont to say. In LFP 006, John Shaw, Head of Innovation and R&D at Direct Line, gave us the big code view of the impact of fintech upon insurance. In this episode, Stephen will explain why there are so few insurance fintechs out there. The company that Stephen founded and now runs is Bought by Many, which is one of the leading lights in insurance fintech. It is social insurance. We'll hear more about that in the show, but a quote from their website. Everyone's different. It's what makes us human. So why should being different make insurance difficult and expensive to get? Bought by Many is a free, members-only service that helps you find insurance for the things in your life that are out of the ordinary. It's easier than using a comparison website or trying insurance companies one at a time. They have 248 groups of folks who require specialist coverage, over 60,000 members, that's a lot of Christmas cards, who get an average discount of getting onto 20% to market rates. Like many creative folks, Stephen has had a diverse career. To give you a flavour, he's worked at Aon Consulting, McKinsey, Barclays Wealth, Christie's and Close Brothers. So insurance is a large topic, and without further ado, let's dive into the worlds of insurance, fintech as a whole, and what is social insurance, and is it the antithesis of antisocial insurance? Hi, Stephen. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Mike, thanks for having me on.
Excellent. And I'm very glad to have you on because, as I was just saying beforehand, I'm suffering from a self-inflicted or inflicted by somebody else hangover today. So I'm hoping to catch up for some sleep in the corner while you talk loquaciously. Now, talking of talking loquaciously, going back to your portfolio of former employers, how does one actually move from moving money around the world in banks to moving pictures around the world in Christie's and then go back again?
So, unfortunately, it's not quite as exciting as it may sound.
I just teed it up really well for you there.
I wasn't actually that involved in moving the pictures around, although I have to say that working at Christie's was enormously stimulating. Actually, what I actually did was to build a private bank for the clients of Christie's the Auction House. Everything around art, whether that was insuring, investing, or buying art, borrowing to buy or borrowing against art. Although it is the first time in my career at that point that I had ever had a job that anyone wanted to have a conversation with me about it at a dinner party. Until now, of course, that is, where everyone just wants to talk to me all of the time because it's much more interesting doing something from scratch than it is going to work for a large corporate.
No, indeed. I remember doing natural sciences at college, and my elder daughter is now thinking of doing the same. And I didn't realise until I got there that it has completely zero cachet. You go to somebody at the party, and what you do, I do natural sciences.
Yeah, well, I think that's true for everything. In fact, my son also wants to do natural sciences. And, you know, I have forewarned him that this is likely to be a bit of a showstopper for him.
He's not going to pull any hot chicks that way.
Yes.
So notwithstanding the fact that you weren't actually sort of flogging the pictures as such, it must have been a very different environment in terms of the type of people there.
Yeah, and that's definitely true. That is definitely true. And actually, I was a different kind of person for them as well. So whilst I found it enormously interesting to literally travel around the globe and build this business based out of London, Hong Kong and New York, I was taken under the wing of many of the art experts and taught about art. I mean, I think it's fair to say that I knew literally zero about old masters until I got there and now have this enormous passion, particularly for Cranach, actually. It's
interesting. Oh, right.
So,
okay.
So there was a recent exhibition at the Royal Academy of Cranach and I was the first in the line to go see it.
That's not Fanny Craddock, is it?
No, Cranach. Yes, Cranach.
Cranach, sorry. Yeah. So I'm not such an art as you. So this is actually probably your main motivation then in trying to form one of these unicorns and make a billion and that you can go around buying all these old masters or something.
Well, I'm not quite sure that I've got the house to show it off, or indeed it's appropriate to show off art in your own house. I think it should be on public display, but that's for a separate conversation.
That's always my thing. That's why I do the podcast for free. I'm interested to see, though, that you didn't correct me on the idea that Bought by Many will be a billion-dollar unicorn, which may be related to you chatting to VCs at the moment.
Well, I think that the idea of being a unicorn and not having enough revenue to justify it is not something that's in my agenda right now.
Excellent. And you also have done quite a bit, going back to the transitions between these various career phases in startups and helping other people with startups.
Yeah, I mean, that's completely correct. So right back in the 90s, I built an investment consulting business, which ended up being owned by Aon. And then I was part of the team that helped build Barclays Wealth. From there, I built the private bank at Christie's, the auction house, as I was just saying. And then I went to run the wealth management business at Close Brothers, where we built a national advice service and integrated a direct consumer execution only offering into that. And so, you know, my takeaway is that I had done a lot of startups just on somebody else's balance sheet and for somebody else and to their drumbeat, if you like. And I was sick and tired of doing it for others, and it was time to do it for myself.
Yeah, and as we were just discussing when we're putting the microphone together, there's immense value in the modern world of doing something, not just this kind of hyper-capitalism all to do with billions of dollars and all that kind of stuff, but much more simply, just creating not only employment for people, but interesting employment for people. Yeah, and actually, that's incredibly rewarding.
Yeah, and that's completely true. So I'm completely in that space. So there are now 12 of us. I get a real kick out of the fact that there are 12 great individuals working together, that we have created some job. We have some new graduates who have not had jobs before. We have individuals who've been in large corporates and been bored, frankly, kind of almost brain dead in those jobs, and now who feel stimulated and excited to turn up in the morning and do something genuinely of relevance to consumers around the UK.
Yes, it's interesting because occasionally I do think of a sort of more what a European vibe might be to tech, because it's so dominated by the American model of tech and the American model of what you might call sort of hyper-capitalism, which is all around this, you know, infinite, limitless greed and $1 billion and all this kind of stuff. But I had Nectarius on from Startup Bootcamp a little while ago, and when I was reading their website, you know, they're an accelerator incubator started in Europe and still based in Europe. If you go to their website, one of their sort of their big claims in quite large type is we've created this many jobs.
Yes.
You know, and given what the unemployment situation is across Europe, I think a European model might have something along the lines that, you know, if somebody like you forms a successful company, that of course you should make decent money, but being, quotes, European, you don't need to be worth 9 figures.
Yes.
And, you know, if you're worth 8 figures and create a lot of jobs, maybe that's really
right.
Good.
Yeah, and maybe my shareholders should opine on whether that's how they feel about things as well.
Well, that's one of the problems. That is one of the problems. And I've had this, and that's one of the problems with sort of VC stuff in general, because they spray and pay and hope that sort of one of their things hits the bullseye to make off the rest. And I've had conversations off the record with a number of fintechs. And actually, this is one of the pressures that they find. So one or two people have said to me, well, personally, I'm not that ambitious, but my shareholders are.
Right.
You know, so there is a difficulty with that. But anyway, you know, the main point here is that along the way, one is creating interesting employment.
Yeah, and I think that for us, we also have this enormous focus on consumer advocacy. So it's very important for us that we are doing something that is of material benefit to the consumers in the insurance space. And we see very little happening in the insurance space that has consumer advocates at its centre, doing something for the good of individuals at its centre. And if we can do a small part of helping move the insurance industry forward and making it a little bit more modern, then we'd be pleased with that as well.
Yes, that fits into the nice modern ideal of a purpose-driven business.
Yes, and we genuinely believe that. So you were reading before a quote from our website about individuals should be able to get insurance that meets their needs. We just also believe that individuals know other individuals in the same space as them, and that creating a social way of bringing people together, we create communities, we refer to them as groups, but we think about them as communities. And as you said before, we have currently 248 of them. And these are people who have something materially in common with each other.
So just to give people a feel for this, so when we met the first time, you were telling me a fascinating story about little dogs that you can carry under your arm if you're in Hollywood anyway. So just give people a bit of a feel for this before we sort of dive into fintech innovation and insurance and the important issues there. So tell me about little dogs, or tell the listeners about little dogs.
Right. So interesting that you pick on pets. Pets was the part of the insurance sector we started in first, and we can talk a little bit later about where we're focused now. But it's interesting. So the little pets that you're referring to are pugs. Pugs are small dogs. They are incredibly friendly, and there are not that many of them around. And the implication of both of those things is that they are quite frequently stolen. This being, you know, somewhat odd to those of us who own a Labrador, who
exactly.
On some level might be quite happy for their dog to be stolen. But the implication of all of that is that these dogs are frequently stolen. And because they are very expensive to buy, they're very expensive to replace.
Roughly.
So a typical pug pug will cost outside London £1,700 and maybe a little bit more than that inside London.
That's incredible. And how big is a pug? It's less than 12 inches, isn't it?
Yes, you fit on your forearm.
So you're paying quite a lot per inch, aren't you?
Yes. The piece that's relevant in insurance in this is that a typical pet insurance policy would pay out £500 or £600 if you lost your pet for whatever reason that might be. And so you buy this expensive insurance policy, and insuring pugs is expensive. Then, unfortunately, your pug is stolen, and the pet insurer pays out £500, and you are left significantly out of pocket as you reluctantly and begrudgingly go buy another one because you're kind of upset that you've lost your original pet, and you're out to the tune of more than £1,000 as well. So we worked with a leading pet insurer to create a bespoke policy specifically for this breed. It pays £2,000 reward for the safe return of your beloved pet. It pays out £2,000 to advertise that reward. And if the pet still isn't returned, it pays you £2,000 to go buy another one.
Right. So that's an example of where there was a gap in the market, and you're Correct. Filling the gap in the market. So there's not so much the digital angle on that one. Or is there?
Well, the digital angle is that we don't know that many pug owners in the UK, but we do know that people search online in Google and wherever are the search engines for pug insurance, specifically for pug insurance. We do know that on social networks, particularly in Facebook and Twitter, people talk about these issues. And we do know that those who have these issues know others who have these issues.
Okay, so when you say social insurance, and just going back to words like that, which obviously you guys live, but other people may not have heard, you're really just talking about, if you draw the sort of usual Venn diagram, social stuff like Facebook groups and that kind of stuff on the one circle, and the other circle called insurance.
Yes.
There's an overlap, and where you show the overlap, that's kind of what you're doing.
And we think that overlap is very large. Right. So we think that although people might not have the psyche right now to understand that that is large, most of our communities, these 248 groups that we have right now, are people who are just talking about owning a pug or having Crohn's and looking for travel insurance. They're not focused on the insurance aspect so much, they're more focused on the implications of their particular affliction or their pet or their gadget or the type of house that they've got. And they're talking about that. So, for example, we have a Sharpei group. Sharpeis are dogs with a kind of very wrinkly skin. And the photo on our Facebook page for Sharpeis has a Sharpei sitting in water. And the group are discussing whether Sharpeis like water or not. Now, this is really interesting for us because they're having this conversation on an insurance discussion group. The discussion is not at that point about insurance, but it is very clear that that discussion is taking place under the banner of insurance. And so this for us is why we describe ourselves as insurance made social, because we want people to engage with each other, and they have lots in common with each other, just we're doing it under the banner of insurance, and then when it comes up for their time of insurance, we'd like to think that we can help them satisfy that as well.
Right, so you're hosting them basically sort of social networks.
We're hosting the discussion groups.
Right, okay. So I mean, I remember my first foray into social media on the interweb was when I became independent in 1998 and got an office in Cannon Street and had my first laptop. I was on the Concept 2 rowing machine forum, which sounds like a very dull thing, but you'd be amazed at sort of what conversations that people can have on that. Because otherwise you're ploughing up and down in your rowing machine at home and it's all a bit dull, but then you come and go, oh, I just so many metres in this time and da-da-da-da-da.
And you have something in common with them.
And you have something in common with them. And it got incredibly sort of high-pressured at one point, and there were sort of death threats from one person to another, which someone was ex-special forces and had been wound up by somebody else.
Not sure we want to encourage that.
No. Indeed. But the passion that can be generated within a group like that, and I could perfectly well see that, you know, it's the other way around, which is that this was a forum under Concept 2. But if somebody says, oh, by the way, we insure your rowing machines twice as cheaply as anybody else or something, in that case someone steals it to order.
Yes.
Then you've got a ready-made group of people.
Right.
You don't just have to go to Google AdWords, everyone types in Concept 2 rowing machine insurance.
So I'll give you another example. So we have home insurance groups and we group people by their hobby. Take a good example, home insurance for cyclists. If you are a keen cyclist, as I am, you will know that insuring your cycling kit is hard. The insurers are very particular about where you bolt it, and that when you use it, it's only insured if you're physically out on it. Kind of huge constraints and expensive to insure. And we have worked with a particular insurer to put together a group of people who are cyclists who are looking for home insurance. Your cycling kit is insured for nothing. And in addition to that, you'll get a 10% discount off your home insurance policy. And so cyclists know other cyclists because they cycle in groups, in pelotons. And, you know, and when we're out on a Sunday morning cycle ourselves, we're kind of discussing a whole, banging the world to rights, discussing a whole manner of things. And we want other cyclists to be talking about, oh, when your home insurance policy comes up for renewal, have a look at this. This is looking interesting.
Yes, I have to drive around one way or another, sort of the Surrey Hills sometimes at the weekend, especially sort of being my main role in life, which is down taxi these days. And ever since the Olympics, you know, you just keep swatting these cyclists like, you know, flies on the windscreen because they're all going up and down the Olympics. Olympic course and all that kind of thing on the country roads. So going back to the big picture then, Stephen, in terms of your sort of song and dance routine, so zooming back out to insurance industry and fintech and innovation as a whole, it's true to say, of course, that the vast majority of fintechy innovation so far has been around banking and payments and that kind of stuff, and not so much around insurance. So what's the sort of hyper big picture point on that from your perspective?
So I think it's hard for large-scale insurers to innovate. And I've been asked this a few times before, and it is hard to really put your finger on why that is. I think some of the reason why there's little innovation in insurance is because the kind of individuals who are attracted to go work for large insurers are not the individuals who are well-placed to drive innovation. So I think that from a very base level, insurers are not employing the kind of individuals who are going to drive innovation.
That's true, but that should also mean that there's much more opportunity for small startups such as yourself. But there aren't hundreds and thousands of insurance startups.
No, not at all. Very, very few. I mean, the number of insurance startups in Europe, you can literally count on the fingers of one hand. We know them all. And we're all mutually supportive of each other because it is very hard to innovate in insurance because most insurers are large businesses. Regulation is hard in insurance. It's, you know, in some regards, it's not as hard as it is in banking, but it is definitely tough. And there are not that many individuals out there who have both insurance expertise and knowledge and the creative aspect and the drive to go set up and run an insurance startup. And it takes, you know, a degree of stupidity to go leave a large, predictable corporate and to go do that. And so, you know, we know that very few have done it, and it is very hard, and it takes a very long time. And the longer it takes before there are many successful insurance startups, that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So that, you know, the more startups in the insurance space that are successful, the more there will be. And that's exactly what's happened in banking, you know, particularly in payments and in mobile technology. But in insurance, there have been very, very few. And until there are two or three that have really genuinely done something of material interest, then I think it will remain hard.
Yes, it's interesting. A couple of things spring to mind. So I was at London Financial News Conference the other week on asset management fintech, and Nick Hungerford, the CEO of Nutmeg, was there. And he was pretty much bemoaning the fact that pretty much he's the only one, and they don't have other people, and actually it makes it very hard in that sector. And it's interesting to wonder why. Then the other thing, coming back to your point about the insurance, I wonder which of these is the case. So looking at lending and borrowing and foreign exchange, so looking at peer-to-peer stuff in the fintechy thing. On the one hand, you've got the sort of Zopas, rate setters, funding circles, who are pretty much doing their own thing separate from the banking system. They need bank accounts and all that kind of stuff, but, you know, somebody rich like you can put money into it and somebody poor like me can take the money out the other side without much difficulty.
So not sure I'm agreeing with that analogy. Yes, I understand the thought.
Well, I'm just being polite, of course. You know, if you're a podcaster like me, you just get showered in wealth. So from one aspect, so as that would apply to insurance, there must be a model where you don't have to touch the big insurers. You can just do it parallel separately. The separate model is things like Currency Cloud and Cantox have been on the show, where actually the majority of what they're doing is not directly peer-to-peer, but the majority, they execute the capacity, the liquidity with the market, with the big banks and that. So how would you say that division works in terms of these sort of insurance fintech startups you're talking about, in terms of, do they have a parallel system where actually they're just kind of doing the insurance as well as interfacing with the consumer? Or actually, are they doing the, well, we interface with the consumer and have somehow we have to lay off the risk in the marketplace?
Right. So first, I mean, I think it is, and probably appropriately so, it is very hard as a startup to take balance sheet risk. Yeah. And I think the FCA makes it hard, and I think that's appropriate that it's hard. And consequently, as a startup, you have to interface with the insurance market, a kind of a broad amorphous mass of the insurance market. Whether you choose to do that with an MGA, a managing general agent on one side, with Lloyd's of London, with a regular commercial broker, or whether you do that with a mainstream insurer, that's your decision. But I think the idea of you doing it literally from zero without interfacing with that, you know, is just not possible. We work with 18 different insurers, and we'd happily work with more. Those two businesses in Europe who have built or starting to build peer-to-peer insurers absolutely work with underlying insurers themselves directly. Even though they market themselves as peer-to-peer insurers, you know, you really have to understand that they have big insurance companies that they work with to offload the risk, because they're not allowed to, and appropriately not allowed to take the risk on completely themselves. And that's hard. So interfacing with large insurers is hard. And I don't think that large insurers intend it to be hard. I don't think that's a systematic, we're going to squash startups, we're going to make it incredibly hard to work with them. But their IT systems are large, they are complex, they are to a great extent old. Some of them have API layers, but very few. and the API layers are not very deep. And so the ability to interact with an insurer on an IT system is small. And so we find ourselves doing more and more work that we initially thought was going to be done by the large insurers ourselves, because that just makes it that much easier to interact with them.
So you're more like peer-to-peer foreign exchange model. But coming back to the compare and contrast, foreign exchange in dollar sterling or something is a huge fungible liquid market. But as you say, sort of pugs and shiatsus and Crohn's disease for travel insurance ain't. So you're much more down the bespoke end where the impact of tech is relatively limited, because you've got to go around and knock on people's doors and say, hey, look, do you want to do pugs, yes or no, and have a long conversation about it.
A few things to just pick up on what you just said. So firstly, we're not a peer-to-peer insurer. We understand the peer-to-peer insurance model. We don't actually think it's the right one to follow.
So just pressing pause there then. So for the listeners who haven't heard about peer-to-peer insurance, because it's not often discussed, so explain how that model works.
So that means that you would share risk with your next door neighbour, for argument's sake, if you were sharing risk on household insurance policy.
So for example, I'm sure I've heard this thing about, oh, you know, a group of you get together and you insure your iPhones together, and if you lose it, we'll pay you money and that kind of stuff.
Correct, exactly.
To be honest, my initial reaction has always been, well, how can you trust the other people, and does it really work, and what happens when you run out of money, and yada, 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 yada.
All this, and for other reasons, it's not a model that we personally endorse, although there are businesses out there who are playing in this space. So I just wanted to be clear that as a member of Bought by Many, you buy an individual policy in the brand of the insurer that we have introduced you to, in your own name, just on the better terms that we have negotiated on your behalf.
So you're more like a broker in that context.
We are absolutely technically a broker. We are regulated as a broker. We're directly authorised by the FCA as a broker. Maybe it's worth stepping back for a second and explaining what the experience is of a consumer coming to us, and then I'll come back to your question. So if you are in the marketplace for something unusual, and I'll talk about what that means in a second, we will find you because you are searching for something interesting, or because you are on social media, and again, it's kind of primarily Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn, discussing the issues. And so you will find one of our groups, or we will have come to you specifically for that. We don't go to everybody, we'll come to you in a very specific, targeted way if we have a group for something that's relevant to you. You then come onto our site, you join the group. We encourage you to invite other people you know into that group for whom this may be relevant, and then you click through from the group to the underlying insurance offering that we have already negotiated to buy it directly from the insurer, just on the better terms. Better might be cheaper, better might be more appropriate or more tailored cover, and then you buy it in the same way that you would ordinarily buy it. I think that what's interesting is that what I've just described is how most people would see us, right? It's how most people would experience us, it's how the press describes us, and how our 62,500 members think about us. Interestingly, we actually start in quite a different place from that. And this is the learning that we had right early on in the setup of the business that's now been going for just over 2.5 years, is that working with these insurers is hard. So actually, we've turned the tables around quite a lot, and we now start with insurers. And we say to insurers, tell us what areas you want to build more risk exposure.
Nice. So you're more like a customer acquisition vehicle then?
Except that we only bring them customers that we know exist, and we know where the customer need exists. So we say to insurers, tell us what areas you want more risk exposure. And there are a variety of reasons why an insurer might answer that question. Something to do with Solvency II, something to do with cost of acquisition, something to do with underwriting exposure. And so that's the supply side of our equation. Where consumers are searching for specific risks, or where we can see them discussing it on social media, that's the demand side of our equation. And where we find overlap between the two, we create groups.
So basically what you're saying is that you're more nimble because you're sort of small and startup, and you've got superior knowledge of, on the one hand, what's out there and people are looking at, and on the other hand, what insurance companies would like to do, and you're joining the two in an efficient digital fashion.
Exactly, 100% correct.
So coming back to the insurance as a whole, so it seems that some of the simple answers about why there isn't so much innovation in insurance is that if you're going to be, let's call it, a fintech insurer, well, actually, you're going to be an insurer. And if you want to be an insurer, you've got to be quite big. Because if I just insure one person, if I insure your bike, either make a tiny little bit of money or
the risk
I get completely stuffed.
Yes.
Exactly. So insurance tends only to work in terms of capacity on a very large scale in the first place. Secondly, the regulation around insurance, like most of the financial services, just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And there's a huge cost of being in that business. So these two things are slowing it down quite a lot. And so from what you're saying, you've got the peer-to-peer model where people are just trying to
do a pass-through kind of thing, pass-through of risk, and then you've got the other models like yours, where you're interacting with a deep marketplace and interfacing more nimbly with some very focused segments, which they're not necessarily able to do.
Exactly, and coming back to the question you were asking before.
You've got good memory, because I can't remember what question I was asking before.
So you said to us, is this quite a small part of the marketplace? And actually, we have had some analysis done for us that has showed that the part of the marketplace we're focused on is at least as big as 40% of the UK retail insurance marketplace.
Wow. How does that work then? I'd assume most of the insurance is like, I don't know, health or travel or cars, and you know, that's 80% done or something, life insurance.
Right, so you're just describing that in very big sectors. Yeah. So if you are a mainstream driver with a mainstream car with a good clean track record, then you should absolutely go to a price comparison site, because that's where you're going to get the best deal. But if you're an older driver or a younger driver, if you've got multiple convictions, if you've got a criminal record, if you've got an unusual car, you've got a left-hand drive car, you've modified your car in some way, then you will not be best served by that route. You've got a vintage car, you join a vintage car owners club, and you get your insurance through the vintage car owners club.
So just pressing pause there, again, just making an analogy with banking, are we really talking here about liquidity? So if we're doing dollar sterling, it's a liquid market and you can get the best price by going to wherever. If you're doing Zambian kwacha against real or something.
Yes, but except that I would just say that another way of looking at taking your analogy might just be that I've only got £500 that I want to put into dollars. You know, if there were no high street currency converters, then the only way I'd have to do it would be to go to a corporate broker and they wouldn't be interested in my £500. And what we're saying here is that actually there are lots of people who have got £500 who want to convert it into dollars.
Oh, I see. So you're joining them all together.
We're joining them together and we're creating a marketplace, and we're finding the insurer who likes that marketplace.
So you're doing a retail to wholesale transformation then? You're finding lots of retail punters with a similar thing.
Yes.
And then an insurance company wouldn't be interested in dealing with one person with one pug.
Yes.
But you come along and say, oh, we've got 1,000 people with 1,000 pugs, and actually this is worth you doing. Then they pay attention.
And they pay attention, they'll create something bespoke or relevant to that marketplace. And we're introducing willing buyer to willing seller at that point.
So just thinking about it from the sort of the retail food chain or whatever, you know, you've got wholesalers who then sell to retailers and retailers send to the public. It's almost like you're operating that in a different way around. You're starting with the public, and as a retailer you then go and sell something to the wholesaler.
Yes, and we are definitely turning things on its head, and I guess that's one of the reasons why we describe this as insurance 3.0.
So what was 1.0 and 2.0?
So we see mainstream face-to-face broking in the insurance market as a typical insurance intermediary that's been around for many years. My grandfather was a broker for the Pearl Assurance Company for 49 years. And that model absolutely is alive and well, completely alive and well, particularly for unusual risks. And then about 25 years ago, the advent of direct sellers and price comparison sites, and we describe that as insurance 2.0. And now we're looking at the advent of social and mobile, and we haven't really touched on mobile, but we definitely should do. And we see that as insurance 3.0.
Okay, so time's going by. So social we've ticked off. We've ticked off innovation insurance. And just before we tick off the innovation insurance, do you see anything out there that's going to change it very much? Because these dynamics we discuss, which is either you try and create your own capacity, but that's quite hard without turning into an insurance company, or you're actually just interfacing with insurance and regulation. Those dynamics aren't really going to change very much. Can you imagine that in a few years' time you have 10 or 100 times the number of insurance startups?
I can certainly imagine a scenario where there are more insurance startups. And I think that what's interesting about the insurance world is that there are smaller, in some cases very small, insurance businesses. I'm not quite sure I'd call them insurers, but insurance businesses that have been around for many, many, many years. Just their issue is they have no route to market. So they're only selling through face-to-face brokers. So if today you are in an unusual marketplace, you've got an exotic car and you want to insure it, you've got an unusual health risk and you want to insure it, you have to go to a face-to-face broker. And these face-to-face brokers, A, will charge you 30 to 35% commission, which you're not realize because it's buried, but they will then go to these much more nimble but much smaller insurance businesses who will put together the insurance package for you one-on-one. And so whilst the insurance industry as a whole has never really innovated, there are lots of smaller businesses around, and insurance brokers are often one-man bands.
Yes, indeed. So going back to the mobile then, so that was the social. The mobile insurance, what's that then? You said it's important. So am I supposed to insure my house on my phone?
Right, exactly. Looking at your phone sitting on the table in front of us, right?
I should have insured it against breaking the screen, of course.
Yes, I can see. I did notice you hadn't looked after it very well. And 77% of our members join us on some kind of mobile device. Everything we do is specifically designed to look good and be, you know, to be interactive on, regardless of how big the screen is.
I'm lucky this is a podcast because I never have to look good. I just have to sound good.
Yeah. You do that as well. And that's a real issue because our members then click through to the underlying insurance business to go complete their acquisition. The insurance website is not mobile enabled. So you have to wait until you get home in the evening to log on from a desktop at home and to complete the acquisition. And we see that. We watch people kind of get so far through the process, step out and come back several hours later. And that's frustrating for individuals and actually unnecessary.
And I think the other thing that's changed these days in the world of overload and that everybody's got smartphones is that after a day sitting at your office PC and then commuting around and, you know, pressing buttons on your smartphone, the last thing you want to do when you get home is turn your own PC on again and start messing around with that.
Yes.
Whereas if you're stuck on some train outside London Bridge, you'll press a few buttons on your phone and get something useful.
And this is beginning to happen, but it's really very early stages.
Very early stage. So time's moving on. In terms of the bought by many, Stephen, what do you think the sort of key things of interest you are that you'd like to sort of share with the world?
So from our perspective, we really feel like we've only scratched the surface of what is possible. So we started in pet, and about half of our groups are in pet. We then moved from pet to travel, and we do travel insurance for older travellers. We do gap year travel. We do travel insurance by medical affliction.
He says through gritted teeth, how are you defining older?
Oh, so it becomes harder to buy travel insurance once you get past 65.
I'm all right then. I'm still younger.
And I believe that we have the oldest annual travel insurance policy available anywhere in the UK. Right. So that once you get past 70, it's almost impossible to buy annual travel cover, even though you might be, you know, A, financially able to travel, and you've finally got the time on your hands to travel.
Yeah.
In fact, insuring it becomes very hard.
And you kept cycling for so long that you're actually fit still.
So we're doing that. We're doing travel insurance for people with particular medical afflictions. You mentioned Crohn's. We do diabetes. We do COPD. We do a big variety of those. Then we went from there, and we now do some work in home insurance. And then a few weeks ago, we launched private medical insurance, and we do private medical insurance.
How do you keep track of all this stuff? Have you got a big brain or something to remember all these things you do with 268 groups?
248, please. You're ahead of us already.
Well, we've been here for half an hour, so there must be a few more by now.
It's ranked by group, by type of insurance, by sector on our site. And we're keen to do more. We're very keen to do more. We have constrained ourselves to the UK for this year alone, but we've had many, many, many overseas approaches to take this technology and this capability into other markets, and it would work in most other developed countries.
I can imagine it can, and I understand how you're acquiring people because of the sort of searchy terms that people put in, but vice versa. So if you're a listener to this show and you think, oh, what my many sounds very interesting, it must be a bit tricky to do it the other way around, which is somebody goes to your site and goes, oh, there's all these groups. It might take them quite a long time to click through 268 and find which one is particularly relevant to them. Because I assume that with 268 groups, there's actually going to be quite an overlap, but it's quite tricky that way around, isn't it?
Right. So firstly, not many people do that. But if you go onto boughtbymany.com, right in the center of the screen, there's a big blank white gap and it says, what insurance are you looking for? So just type in there and we will direct you to something that is relevant to you. So if you type in Dalmatian, you'll get introduced to the Dalmatian group, et cetera, et cetera. If there's something you're looking for and we don't have it, we'll ask you to tell us about it. So if there's a group out there of people who are looking for something and that insurance is either hard to come by or doesn't exist at all, tell us.
Okay, so for example, if I'm a podcaster and I'm looking to insure myself against pressing the delete button by mistake the day after, as many of us do, because then I've got to come back groveling and say, oh, very sorry, Mr. Mendel, I deleted the podcast, can we do it all over again? And I get enough of my buddies together, then you will...
Absolutely. So we've had quite a few examples of that. So we've had an example of quad bikers. So people who are kind of driving quad bikes for fun on private land couldn't get any insurance for it. And in fact, the secretary of a quad biking group came to us and said, I will bring you all of the members of our society if you can get us an insurance policy that covers us. We did something similar for older dogs. We did thatched houses. These are all ideas that individuals have come to us with. That they said, this is a material issue for us. We're not alone. We know many others. Can you help us solve this problem?
So that's really clear then, David, because I did kind of wonder about social insurance like most of these phrases. It seems to be two words put together. But actually, the way you explain it, it's kind of clearer than the phrase in a sense. The phrase is a shorthand, which, yes, if you know what it is, it makes a lot of sense.
Right. We won't be out there talking about insurance made social. We'll be out there talking about the issues in the insurance marketplace and how we're doing our small bit to build consumer advocacy in insurance so that people are out there talking about it, they're happy to talk about it. Insurance is not a dirty word, and we're comfortable that we can help solve a lot of problems. You know, clearly we can't solve all of them in one fell swoop, but we're working on that trajectory.
So going forwards then, if I was your fairy godmother and I had a nice sort of wand and I could sort of magic away some obstacles or I could, you know, liberate various possibilities, I mean, where do you want to be in a year's time?
So we would like to be offering many more groups, working with a broader range of insurers across a broader number of insurance segments. One of the big ones we're looking, desperately trying to find an insurer who wants to work with us in is young drivers.
I've got one of those coming up. She's passed her theory test and she's got the practice test coming up next.
So you won't have got the quote yet for how much it's going to cost to insure her, but steel yourself for that moment.
Exactly. She wants a pickup truck, but I don't think that's going to happen.
So this is a material problem. We've got a very large, active group of young drivers who are quite keen to prove that they understand the issues with insuring themselves, but also keen to find someone who can help them solve some of these issues. So we would desperately like to try and find an insurer who wants to work with us to create a sensible offering to this group. But we're looking to expand in a number of different spaces. So we are out there in the marketplace looking for insurers who want to target specific risks. Don't come to us and say, I want to grow our entire book, because that's of no interest to us.
And so what's, getting back to my fairy godmother wand, what's the principal limiting factor on the rate of expansion at this stage?
So I think the limiting factor is just finding insurers who can be specific enough about the groups they want to grow and working with us on an IT basis to enable us to introduce those groups in. And just to be clear, these policies don't have to be bespoke. So for insurers who can't bespoke a policy, and many of them cannot, an economic incentive to bring them exposure to those risks is sufficient. So you started by saying that there's an 18% discount on average across all of our policies. So if you're an insurer who's looking to grow a particular segment, a financial incentive also works because your cost of acquisition through us will be much lower and our renewal rates are much higher. So we'll also help you to grow your book in that regard.
Excellent. Well, time has flown by and it's been really interesting talking to you. As you say, there aren't many out there, and I think it's quite clear to the listener that your enthusiasm and the eloquence for this and the nice, simple, clean business model you've got. I mean, I've now spent the better part of a year talking to fintechs of all sorts, and one of the distinguishing factors, which might be interesting for those who don't earlier down the curve with your startup, is it does need to be simple and clear. Simple, clear, and well executed will take you a long, long way.
Right. You know, from our side, we're not looking to squash insurers. We want to work with them. And I think that the message to other startups is, you know, work with the industry. Don't try and take it head on. It will be much, much, much harder. So we're working with insurers. We want to take them on a journey of understanding that there's huge opportunities in the marketplace. And we're very happy to help them realize those opportunities and at the same time for individuals build advocacy around what is possible.
Excellent. Well, that's a very good way to sum up, and thank you for your time today, Stephen.
Mike, thank you very much to you too.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts and new episodes. Live long and prosper.
Could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, but with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so grey, with the pain of the the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight.